Sydney. Welcome to the final act.
There is one mystery more terrifying than you know.
Who is this?
There is one secret that can never be revealed until the end.
Get out behind you!
What do you know about trilogies?
All I know about movie trilogies is that in the third one, all bets are off.
Scream 3.
Don't panic.
And welcome to Unloved Sequels, the podcast that brings you a blow-by-blow critique of Hollywood's worst-rated sequels. You know, the ones that some people think should never have been made. We're your hosts. Michael, say hello.
Hello!
And I'm Claire. In this episode, we've rebuilt our lives after two consecutive years of bloody trauma, but just can't resist heading back into harm's way when a new perpetrator emerges. No, we're not covering the Halloween movies again, but it's definitely an homage rather than a derivative rip-off, right? Michael? What's the movie?
So, Claire, we're heading from small-town suburbia to the bright lights and fame of Hollywood. We're going to take a stab at one of my favourite franchises. This is Scream 3.
Yay!
There's going to be so many people pissed off for covering this because it has such a massive fan base. They're going to be like, it's amazing, don't cover it.
Well,
you know,
people may think it's amazing, but there are things about it that mean that it doesn't sit at the same level as the other movies in the 100%. Franchise. And that is our criteria. We are not here to talk about movies we don't like. We are
exactly.
here to talk about movies that for one reason or another didn't perform as well as the others in their franchise. So
exactly.
just and because we're covering it doesn't mean we think it's shit.
Exactly. And we didn't pick it. So once again...
We did not. Because last Halloween, we just ended up doing all the Halloween movies. And so we removed the responsibility from ourselves by letting our listeners choose all of our Halloween movies this year.
So, and this time it comes from somebody from my home state, or my current home state, not my birth date, where I live now, from somebody from Vermont.
Ooh.
So let's hear from Jenna.
Oh my God, what is that? Don't bring that near me. No, it can't be. It is. It's the Unloved Sequels Halloween mailbag.
Hi, Claire and Michael. I was wondering if you could cover Scream 3 on the podcast. I'm a big fan of all of the Scream movies, but the third one just doesn't feel like the other movies in the series. I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say on it. Jenna from Vermont.
Well, thanks for the recommendation, Jenna. And as Michael said, this is one of his favourite franchises. So he was very happy to take this on. Michael, tell us about the movie.
So Scream 3 opened on February the 4th, 2000. We're back at that new millennium again.
Ooh.
We've already been once this year. It went on to gross $161.8 million against a budget of $40
million. Oh.
Comparing that to the other two movies that came before it, Scream made $173 million against a budget of $15
million. Okay.
Slightly better. And Scream 2 made $172 million against a budget of $24
million. Okay.
So they've put more money into it. They've got less back. Not
yeah.
dramatically less, but still less back. And I think they just put more money in hoping it would grab more because there's only a $1 million difference between the taking of the first film and the second film. So, and that's very rare to see such a very small decline,
yeah.
like a tiny, tiny decline. So that is really good. Scream 3 ended its domestic year box office at number 23 and it number 27 in the worldwide box office. So for a horror
okay.
film, that's not bad.
It's not.
Now, because we'd already covered the year 2000 a couple of episodes ago with Flintstones and Viva Rock Vegas, I didn't want to go start repeating the same information again and say what the top 10 grossing film of the 2000 was. So if you want to know, Google
go
it.
Listen to that episode. No, don't Google it. Go and listen to our Flintstones episode. Don't Google it. What's wrong with you? We need the stats.
We need
it's all about
we
the
need
listens.
The stats, people. Go back and listen to that episode.
It's a good episode. It's a double episode.
It's a double episode with some great guests.
Everyone
so
get
go
one
back
free.
And listen to it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, it's all free because we don't charge anyone. So,
well, I know, buy one for nothing and get another one for nothing.
So I thought I'd look at the top grossing movies in America and Canada, the domestic box office instead. Because it varied slightly different. So
you're not expecting me to remember the one from, I know it was only a couple of months ago that we did Flintstones.
Oh my God, you shouldn't frown so hard, Claire. She's frowning like so hard right now.
Because of my lines. You're going to make me think about stuff. I can't remember yesterday, let alone an episode we recorded 2 months ago.
No, I'm not. So, good. But it's very different because there's films on it that wasn't on before. I know it, but you don't need to know it. So at number 10, Erin Brockovich.
Mm-hmm.
Number 9, Disney's Dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
Number 8, What Lies Beneath. Number 7, Scary Movie. What's quite ironic seeing that. That's why I wanted to do it, because that wasn't in the worldwide one, just in America. So that was quite interesting. Scary Movie was very big that year. Scary Movie grossed more money than Scream 3 did.
That's mad.
Figure that out.
That is mad.
Nuts, isn't it? That's nuts. Number 6 is X-Men. Number 5 is Meet the Parents. Number 4 is The Perfect Storm. Number 3 is Gladiator. Number 2 is Mission Impossible 2. And number 1, starring Claire's favourite person of all time, who she loves and watches all back catalogue of all their work, at Jim Carrey's How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
My kids like that film. I don't mind that one as
much. Why, because he's in latex?
Well, but yeah, and because he's not... The thing, I don't like funny Jim Carrey. I'm doing like air quote marks as I say that. Because I think when he's just acting, he's a very talented actor. And he's very funny when he's being a dramatic actor. I just find the whole kind of stretchy face shtick that he had in his early movies just too much for me. But I like him as an actor. We watched The Truman Show a couple of weeks ago, actually, me and my husband. Really enjoyed it. Like, not for the first time. I've seen it loads of times before, but not for a while. So we did a rewatch.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's a really good movie. He's a really talented actor, but I much prefer him in those sorts of roles to the kind of Ace Ventura kind of masky type. The Grinch isn't so bad because he's not doing the kind of crazy faces stuff. It's just the latex work, but it's fine. I watch it because my kids like it.
And we've got another crossover with The Mask, like you said, with Jamie Kennedy being in The Mask too, that we've also recovered.
We have.
In a previous episode, the Son of the Mask. Yeah. So go and listen to that episode and don't Google it. Apparently.
Don't Google it. I don't think you'll find much if you Google that one anyway, to be fair.
No, that's true. So other unloved horror sequels that were released that year were Blair Witch Project 2, Book of Shadows, Urban Legend Final Cut, and Hellraiser Inferno. I think is Hellraiser 5. I'm not too sure. I think it's Hellraiser
5. I don't know.
It currently sits at 341 in the all-time worldwide sequel box office, just sitting between Insidious Chapter 2 and Live and Let Die. Live and Let Die! Yeah. Boom, boom!
Beneath Live and Let Die, I presume.
No, above Live and Let Die. So it's in between Insidious 2 and Live and Let Die.
Because Live and Let Die is a cracking sequel.
So Scream 3 also sits at number 52 in the all-time worldwide horror box office chart. So that's all horror sequels.
Okay.
I found a really interesting chart on the website Numbers, which really goes deep into box office numbers for horror films, what I found really exciting. Matter of fact, let's just step away from Scream for a second. This is quite interesting. What do you think the biggest grossing horror movie of all time is? Because I was shocked by this, and I thought you might find it quite interesting.
Oh, gosh. Biggest grossing. It's not going to be one of the ones you expect, is it? I don't know.
This is worldwide.
I don't know.
Just pick one. Come on.
I don't know.
You love a pop quiz.
I know, but you didn't prepare me for this. I don't know. Like one of the Halloweens? No, it's not going to be one of the Halloweens, is it?
No.
It's going to be something more modern than that.
Well, I thought it was The Exorcist because we covered The Exorcist last week.
And yes, I would say that's probably the highest rated, but probably not the most commercially successful.
Well, that was the highest grossing film of that year. This movie is the highest grossing horror film, but not the highest grossing film of the year it came out. It's actually 2017's It, Part 1.
it?
Yeah, I found that really interesting. And a matter of fact, the
Wow.
sequel is also in the top five. So it's the only horror franchise that has both a original entry and its part two slash sequel in the top 100. I found that really interesting.
Yeah. I suppose
Yeah,
that, you know, there was a
yeah.
lot of hype about that movie and
It
it had a lot of
was.
traction. And it's
Well,
a
it has
good
a
movie.
huge. It's a good movie. It has a lot of traction with people that read the book for one generation, and then you
Yeah.
had another generation
And then
like
the
us
TV
who grew up. It,
miniseries.
that's what we grew up on, the
Yep.
TV miniseries.
Grew up on, like.
We
You shouldn't be
did.
growing up on any version of it. This should be something you discover as an older teen, not growing up
Yeah,
on
this
any
is
of
true.
this. But
This is true.
yeah. That's really interesting. I wouldn't have expected it. I was expecting something a bit more recent than the kind of 70s classics. I wouldn't have said something as recent as 2017, though.
No, I was
Oh,
also thinking kind of
no.
like maybe Halloween 2018, you know, the redone of the Jamie Lee Curtis one. Or I maybe even thought so Psycho because it was the biggest grossing film for a period of years. So
Yeah.
I was like, oh, well, and I was a bit, no. Psycho's in, I think it's in the, Psycho and Jaws are in the top three with it.
Yeah.
Not Psycho, Exorcist, sorry. Exorcist and Jaws are in the top three with it. So like they are up there. It took like about 700 million. So it was nearly up to a billion, just over. It was really impressive. But in our Rotten Tomato section, Scream 3 is the weakest rated Rotten Tomato score out of all the Scream franchises. So when we look at this, guys, we're not going to discuss, and we're not going to be mentioning in this podcast past Scream 3 because we're looking at it as a trilogy, mainly because Claire hasn't seen past Scream 3.
No, and I was going to, but
Yeah,
so
you have
all
a
of the
life.
no, well, no, I wouldn't go that far. All of the Scream movies are on Sky Cinema in the UK at the moment, which I have a subscription to, except for Scream 4, because I watched the first three, rewatched for this, and thought, you know what, just for completion, I'm going to carry on. It's the time of year, I'm going to carry on. And then I was like, oh, I can't because Scream 4 is not on Sky Movies. I could watch 5 and 6, but I can't watch four without a Paramount subscription.
I can give you my login to something. Shh, people.
Doesn't work in the UK. I've tried it before.
Oh, not the Paramount one, my other clouds. I saw one of my other clouds.
Oh, I looked and I couldn't find it.
Now, it's on one of the clouds I haven't even logged in for because it's an American account. But if you put on a VPN,
Jeez.
then
I don't even know what you're talking about. I
that
don't even know what a VPN is. I've never heard of
was.
it.
Not at all.
Anyway, so yeah, we're not going to talk beyond Scream 3, partly for spoiler
Yes.
reasons and partly because I haven't seen them.
Yeah, well, I have seen all of them multiple times because this is like my franchise. This is like my Marvel, my Star Wars is a Scream franchise. This is my geek area. So Scream 3 on Rotten Tomatoes, 41% critics, 38% audience. Now compare that to the original first and second part. Scream 1, Rotten Tomatoes scores at 81% critics, 80% audience. And Scream 2 is 82% critics and 58% audience.
Oh, that's quite a
So
big drop
as you can
off.
see, yeah, massive. Audience, not so much. It's kind of like gradually gone down in chunks, but critics did not like this movie. Maybe because they didn't like the portrayal of Hollywood in it, and they're all film critics,
Maybe.
and they all live in that bubble. We don't know. We don't know.
Maybe.
So, but Claire,
Yes.
do you have any behind the scenes stuff for
I
us?
do. Yes. So, starting off with cast and creative team, returning cast, we've got quite a few actually compared to a lot of the films that we've covered recently. So we've got David Arquette back as Dewey Riley, we've got Neve Campbell back as Sydney Prescott, we've got Courtney Cox back as Gail Weathers, credited as Courtney Cox Arquette because by this stage she and David Arquette were married. We've got Lee.
Is she now back to Arquette? No, she's now back to Cox, isn't she? She
Yeah,
dropped
she
Arquette.
dropped the Arquette when they divorced, I think. Yeah.
Okay, very confusing. These
Yes.
poor credit
I
people.
know, it is very confusing. We've got Liev Schreiber as Cotton Weary. We've got Roger Jackson back as the voice, who is the guy on the
Ooh.
end of the phone in all of those scenes. And we've got Lawrence Hecht back briefly as Sydney's dad, Mr. Prescott. We've then got quite an extensive new cast as well, because I guess because of the notion of the movie within the movie, we've got the cast of the movie we're watching, and then we've got the cast of the movie within the movie that we're watching. So we've effectively got double the size of cast to what you'd
normally
have.
And you need victims.
Exactly. Well, it makes for a higher kill count. I think this is probably...
Yes.
I think this movie has the highest kill count of the series so far.
Does it?
I think. I might be wrong. I haven't fact-checked that. Or maybe it's just that it's a higher, the highest kill count per killer. More of which later.
Oh, yes.
So in terms of our new cast, we've got, like, this is like an episode of before they were famous watching this movie. We've got Patrick Dempsey as Mark Kincaid. We've got Lance Henriksen as John Milton. Obviously, he was already famous, Lance Henriksen. We've got Dion Richmond as Tyson Fox, Matt Kiesler as Tom Prince. We've got Jenny McCarthy Wahlberg as Sarah Darling, credited as Jenny McCarthy because this was prior to her marriage. We've got Emily Mortimer as Angelina Tyler. We've got Parker Posey as Jennifer Jolie and Patrick Warburton as Stephen Stone. We've also got cameos from Jamie Kennedy back as Randy Meeks in this movie. So he's a returning cast member, but I would consider that a more of a cameo than a full return, to be honest. Yep. We've got Carrie Fisher in as Bianca, and we've got the most random cameo that I've seen in a movie for a very long time of Jason Mewes and Kevin Smith in as Jay and Silent Bob in a Scream movie. But there is in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, there's a bit where they interrupt the filming of like a fictional Scream sequel. So I guess they've kind of done some reciprocal thing.
Yeah, and I think they're both released by Miramax at the time, so it felt like logical that these paths would cross over.
Yeah. We've got Wes Craven back on directing duties. He directed the previous two installments of Scream franchise. He did go on to direct the fourth installment as well, but of course he's directed so many of all our favorite horror movies. Last House on the Left, Hills Have Eyes, or Nightmare on Elm Street, Wes Craven's New Nightmare. He is arguably the king of the franchise, of the genre. I mean, the movie is written by Aaron Kruger. Now, he doesn't have many credits prior to this film. Pinning your colours to the mast early on this one, Michael. but he went on to write quite a lot of well-regarded films. He wrote The Ring and The Ring 2. Now, obviously, they were adaptations because those movies both already existed in Japanese. So he didn't do the story, but he was on the screenplay for those. Skeleton Key, The Brothers Grimm, Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, Transformers Dark. I think I missed a word out of my notes here. It says Dark of the Moon on my notes. Is that the right?
No, that's
is that what
right.
it's called?
That's right.
No, Dark Side of the Moon is that's a Pink Floyd album.
Yes,
he also wrote Tin Man, which was a TV movie that I loved.
What you love?
I love that movie.
Alan Cumming.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really Alan Cumming, Zooey Deschanel. It was a two-part TV series that's then since then it's been repackaged as a movie, but I don't think it ever had a theatrical release. But you can find it. I can't remember, one of the streaming services has it kind of packaged as a movie. I think it might be Prime. But yeah, brilliant. I love it. And he also wrote on Top Gun Maverick. So it's not like he writes shit, but maybe at this stage of his career he wasn't very experienced. And there were some other factors as well that I will get into when I talk about the production. Kevin Williamson gets a credit in as writer because it's using his characters, but he didn't write on this because he had so many other projects going on. He was in high demand off the back of the success of Scream and Scream 2. So he was writing on Dawson's Creek at this point, The Faculty, Halloween H2O 20 years later, and Teaching Mrs. Tingle. So he just didn't have time to be writing on this as well. And the studio didn't want to wait for him. So they pressed ahead with a different writer. The music is by Malco Beltrami, who did the music for the previous two installments of the franchise. And he also did the music for Scream 4. And loads. I know in our last episode I said that it was possibly the most extensive CV I'd seen for a composer on IMDb. This isn't quite as extensive as that, but Marco Beltrami wrote on loads of movies, and particularly on horrors and thrillers. I started to make a list and then I was like, I don't know which ones to keep in and which ones to miss out. So I'm just, have a look on IMDb and you will see loads of movies that you recognise and that you've seen and enjoyed. And he's done the music for them. In terms of the production itself, so Scream 3 was released just over 2 years after Scream 2. The first two movies, I think, were released in consecutive years, and this was just over two years later. Kevin Williamson's involvement had been contracted. He basically sold the original Scream script as a package with two sequels optioned because he thought that the studios would be more likely to go for it and to buy it from him if they could see potential in it for sequels. So he was tied into being involved, although he didn't end up doing the writing. He is a producer on this movie. And likewise, Wes Craven had been contracted initially for two potential sequels following on from the original movie. So he is back as well. Now, in April 1999, just before this movie went into production, there was a mass shooting at a school in Columbine, which I'm not going to talk about extensively because I think people know this story already, but it had a huge impact on the media and the entertainment industry and the video game industry. There was a lot of scrutiny on those industries and speculation over the reasoning behind the perpetrators' actions. And so there were a lot of people looking at, does violence on TV, does violence in movies, does violence in video games contribute to violence in real life? Which is one of the things that is explored within Scream 3. And so because production hadn't started on this movie, there were conversations about initially whether they should even make the film at this point or whether they should pin it, because they were conscious that if they pressed ahead after what had happened, there might be negative press coming their way. And obviously that might impact negatively on the box office for the movie. But the studio decided to press forward with production, but they were very cautious of the level of violence and the amount of gore that's in the movie. So you can see that there is much less in this movie than there were in the first two installments of the Scream franchise. They kind of wanted to push the movie more towards the sort of satirical humour that had existed in the first two installments, but they wanted that to take the lead and the kind of violence and gore to take a backseat, where it had been much more balanced in the previous installments. At one point, the studio tried to demand that there would be no blood or on-screen violence in the film at all, at which point Wes Craven threatened to quit. Apparently, according to Aaron Kruger, Craven said, "Be serious, guys. Either we make a Scream movie or we make a movie and call it something else. But if it's a Scream movie, it's going to have certain standards. You can't, because it's following on from those two movies, you couldn't really get away with cutting any violence, any blood, any gore completely from the movie, because it just wouldn't work against the other two installments. No. But you can see that there is a difference. And actually, as a result of that scaling down, in this movie, they used 10 gallons of fake blood. Contrasting to that, in Scream 2, it was 30 gallons. And in the original Scream movie, they used 50 gallons of fake blood. So it's significantly less. Yeah.
One fifth of the original.
Yes. So as I said, Kevin Williamson wasn't involved to write the movie, but he did provide an outline, which was then passed to Aaron Kruger and was promptly ignored by Aaron Kruger. He paid very little regard to the outline that he was provided with. And actually, he hadn't seen the first two Scream films before he signed on to write this one. He took the job because
that always boggled my mind when they get like, why go for a job that you don't know, or why does a studio, like, they should, there was enough people out there in Hollywood that were aware of the Scream movies that you know, even they should always go. I always feel like if the original writer isn't available, then speak to the original writer about who he thinks would capture the essence of the original, who, like, rely on him to assign someone or suggest someone to take on the writing mantle.
Yeah.
And Wes Craven, I don't know, I never understood why Wes Craven never wrote Scream 3. He helped Kevin with it.
He did a lot of rewrites in the end with this. So so
he should have just written it, because I think that it would have got more of an essence. And he wrote, like, Wes Craven's New Nightmare, he wrote a lot of his earlier films, Nightmare on Elm Street, A Hills Have Eyes, Last House on the Left. He wrote all of them, and they were well-written movies.
I don't know why he wasn't, or maybe he wasn't considered, maybe he was approached and didn't want to do it, I don't know. But the studio wanted Aaron Kruger. I don't know why. Kruger took the job because it was a chance to work with Wes Craven. So you can see why from his point of view.
Yeah.
And he did, you know, he read back over the scripts of the original two movies. He watched the original two movies, but obviously it was a cram to get it in before writing this. He only had like 6 weeks to turn his first draft around. So he can't have spent very long kind of studying the nuance of the first two movies before writing this.
And also the characters, they're like, we're only two movies deep. You don't know what the characters' essence are, what their journey is supposed to be. Because Kevin Williamson was taking them on a journey through two movies. He had planned the third one. And for Kevin to throw away the original synopsis or, you know,
yeah,
plot of the original third movie, like even to the point of when the whole Columbine shooting happened, they took the movie from suburbia, because this movie was supposed to be set in suburbia. In
yeah, it was supposed Woodsboro, to still be in like Woodsboro. First two. Yeah.
And they took it and moved it to Hollywood so that critics couldn't criticize them because they were doing a satire on violence within.
Yeah.
Movies,
yeah, they wanted to remove any suggestion of possible links between what had happened in Columbine and what would be happening in the movie. So they took it away from Woodsboro, out of suburbia. They made sure that none of the characters that were involved in any of the violent scenes were teenagers. They were all adult characters. Because they just didn't want any parallels to be drawable between what had happened in real life and what was happening in this movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, as you say, the because Kruger wasn't familiar with the previous installments, his character work just didn't pay off. He was he originally wrote Sydney as a kind of Sarah Connor type, you know, where she's retreated off to her safe space at the beginning.
And T2, what we,
yes,
Sarah Connor.
Yeah, yeah. So what we see in this movie is she's quite vulnerable, but actually what she was originally written as was T2's kind of stage Sarah Connor, which was too much of a gear shift from how she'd been in the previous two movies. So yeah, so at that point Wes Craven stepped in and helped with some rewrites, and actually eventually Kruger got fired by the way, having hired them, him in the first place. The Weinsteins then fired him and brought in Lita Kaligridis, I think I'm saying her name right, Lita Kaligridis,
yes,
to do some uncredited rewrites after he was taken off production. He was moved over to writing on Reindeer Games instead, which is not a film I've ever heard of, but it sounds like it's quite different from Scream 3. So the film was shot between July and September 1999. But they then went back in January 2000 to record a new ending. Because in the original ending, Sydney defeated Roman, as she does in the ending that we see. But it was a much more convincing defeat. She basically kicked his ass. Like much as we'd seen in the previous two movies, she defeated him very easily. And then it cut to the kind of the next morning scene of, you know, the police are arriving at the scene. And then it cuts to the scene that we see. I presume it's the same scene of her back at her house with and Dewey and Gail are there, and she's got her dog and all of that. But the production team felt that this kind of, firstly, it felt like three separate endings, like the movie ended and then there was more and it ended again and then there was more. So it felt a bit clunky and it messed up the pacing a little bit. But they also felt that because this was supposed to be the end of the trilogy, it needed to be like, we have the whole scene with Randy saying, you know, that because it's now a trilogy rather than a sequel, all bets are off, the main character could die. And in the original ending there was never any suggestion that Sydney might not survive the movie, so they wanted to reshoot the ending to kind of add that level of jeopardy, to make the audience think that actually maybe she doesn't survive this movie, maybe she's not the final girl. And of course we know that she is, but they wanted to kind of raise the stakes for her. They also had an alternative opening, which I think, I know we said we weren't going to talk about Scream 4, but I think this idea ended up getting worked into Scream 4 somehow. But as I say, I've not seen it, so I don't know exactly how. But the opening scene originally was going to be Sydney and a friend of hers in her house about to watch a movie. And then the killer calls Sydney and her friend, claiming that he's in the house, and he is in the house. The killer jumps out from the closet, tries to attack Sydney and her friend, and then Sydney pulls out a gun, shoots the killer, takes off the mask, and it turns out to be a fan of Sydney, I guess. Yeah. which they scrapped for this movie. I think it might have got reworked into, you will know, I don't. I think it got reworked into something further down the line.
Beginning of Scream, well, yeah, Scream 4, the original idea for Scream 4, well, the idea, what they did in Scream 4 was they did all these kind of like weird opening cut scenes of all the Stab movies.
Right.
They go like, and so they had like celebrities come in and do like cameos.
So because there were issues with the script, so as well as the fact that they'd had to have rewrites from Wes Craven, because of the tight turnaround on the production and because they were concerned about scripts leaking as well, plots leaking. With the second movie, there had been two endings scripted to try and stop anyone from finding out who the killer was ahead of time. And with this movie, I think the level of paranoia, maybe, for want of a better word, was even higher. The concern that the press were going to try and leak the movie was so high that scripts were being rewritten even up to the day of shooting. People were getting a new script shoved into their hands. Cast members were getting just their pages so that nobody knew the outcome of the movie for sure. They didn't even do previews to the press until 2 days before the premiere of the movie because they didn't want to risk it getting leaked. But there were so many constant rewrites going on, partly for that reason and partly because of the script issues with Aaron Kruger. So, which again is kind of parodied within the movie because there are lots of comments from the cast of Stab 3 about how they're constantly getting rewrites even 15 minutes before they shoot. I think that was a bit more meta than you would even realize, that actually that was what was happening on this production as they were complaining in universe about it happening on their production. But there were also huge amounts of footage that were filmed and then didn't get used because the script was being changed so much. Apparently Randy's video message, his posthumous cameo, which I think takes up about 3 minutes of the movie, there was 2 hours of footage filmed for that one tiny scene.
Did they just leave him alone in a camcorder because he's the kind of idiot that would go on for 2 hours?
They probably just went, go for it, mate. Just say what you want to say. Yeah, maybe that's what happened.
But like in the editing room must have been like, what the fuck is happening with this 2 hours?
Yes, that must have been a fun day in the editing room.
I bet.
Yeah. So there was all these constant...
Well, also the whole... Go on. Also there was loads of editing done when it... They changed the opening as well with Cotton Wary, didn't they? Because originally he was supposed to... Well, you can get the... It's on special features where he comes back to the house and thinks his girlfriend's out and she's down the road, but by then she's actually dead. Another scene where he was supposed to be climbing through a skylight and he gets stabbed through the leg, and it's a complete different how they filmed
it. Yeah, so there's a couple of different openings. And then there's one version where they had to refilm because... I'm going to skip ahead now to one of my bits from further on, but we might as well talk about it now because you brought it up. This movie is notable in the series for having only one killer, but that wasn't originally going to be the case. Originally, there were going to be two killers, and the opening scene with Cotton Wary was going to establish that right from the get-go, because the scene where he comes into his apartment to find his girlfriend being attacked, he was still on the phone to Ghostface while Ghostface was attacking him and his girlfriend. So it would make it explicitly clear that there were going to be two killers. So they had to go back and, even after they'd settled on that being the premise for the opening, they had to go back and reshoot it because it made it too clear that there needed to be two killers. And by the time they'd changed everything around so much, they got to a point where there is only one killer in the movie. But actually, there are a lot of elements of the movie that... kind of still suggest they just didn't clean up the fact that they'd started out with two killers and ended up with just the one.
With one.
So the original concept was going to be that Angelina Tyler, the character played by Emily Mortimer, was going to be the second killer. This is the character that plays Sydney in Stab 3. So she was going to be Roman's girlfriend, and she was also going to be a former classmate of Sydney's. And there was going to be this whole weird subplot of like Roman was into her because she played Sydney in the movie and he had this weird kind of incestuous fixation with Sydney, and so he could play out his weird fantasy of sleeping with his sister who doesn't know she's his sister by sleeping with the girl that's playing her in the movie.
But it's also a little bit meta seeing that that's very Star Wars and also Carrie Fisher.
Yes. Oh, yes. I mean, this movie is so meta on meta on meta because, yes, yeah, so you have that hint early on. Well, suppose it's not early on, but you have the hint when you see Carrie Fisher and the fact that, yes, as you say, there was a hint at a romantic relationship between her and Luke. And then you discover in the third installment of their franchise that they are, in fact, siblings.
Yeah.
So there's lots of those little clues kind of planted through this film. One of the reasons that they made the change and took Angelina away as the second killer was because that whole incest fantasy subplot is just ick. But also it was another way of distancing themselves from the Columbine situation because there were two killers at Columbine. So by having just one in this movie, it just pulls that little bit of extra distance between the reality and the movie.
Yeah.
But it did create a lot of plot holes by taking out her as the second killer because it meant that we've already spoiled who the killer is in this movie now. It's Roman. But if you're listening, I'm assuming you've seen the movie, so I don't feel too bad about spoiling that. But it means that he has to be able to travel some crazy distances to get from kill to kill to kill within the time frame.
Yeah, especially that they have. The set scene when they're in the set of Woodsboro in the, the Sunrise Studio.
Yes.
That makes no sense, even though I really like
It's not a full shot-by-shot replica, but it is supposed to be reminiscent of the original chase through Sydney's house in the first movie, which we know was two killers, which explains how they were in so many places. So that kind of doesn't work. The fact that...
And the house at the end.
Yes. The scene where he kills Patrick Warburton's character, so he's on the phone. So this is actually a bit like the Cotton Weary scene that they did spot and took out, and they didn't. I don't know why they didn't clock it this time, but Stephen Stone, the security guard, is on the phone to Ghostface while he's being attacked by Ghostface, who isn't holding a phone. So that there has to be two killers, and then there's that whole big deal of. After the house explodes, Dewey says to Angelina, well, where have you been for the last 5 minutes? Well, we've all been running away from a killer. She disappears and then reappears. And the logistics of that kill don't work if she's not involved because the implication is that she's the one that turns on the gas and then Roman would be sending the faxes.
Yeah, but the power goes out and the fax machine
still works. Yes, that's also a thing. This is not a movie that stands up to having threads pulled is kind of the point that I'm getting at. And there's the whole thing of like, well, what happens with Angelina's death then? Is it a real death or is it a fake out death? Because it was set up to look like a fake out and then you never hear of her again.
Could you also see Roman die? He's in the coffin with a knife through his chest and he's the killer.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't keep... pulling out shreds. And there's that weird scene where Parker Posey is running down the secret corridors in the mansion and she's looking back like somebody's chasing her, even though we see no one chasing her, and she gets to the bottom of the stairs and she's like, oh, there's another one down here, and then runs back up the stairs again. I'm like, why are you looking behind you? There's no one behind you. We haven't seen someone appear behind you.
Yeah.
It's really frustrating.
Yeah.
Because...
That's it. You just frustrating. I felt like there was more of a rant coming. I feel like you've held yourself back from that.
No, that's later. That's later.
Yeah. So there were going to be two killers for various reasons. They took away that element, but they didn't quite clean it up once they took out Angelina as the second killer. The other thing that's worth kind of noting before we get into our kind of main discussion of the movie is a kind of slightly unintentionally meta aspect of this movie, which is that this movie shines a light on the whole casting couch culture years before Me Too happened. And when you look back at that now, knowing that Harvey Weinstein was a producer on this movie.
Yeah. You would think he would go, let's not go down this
road. And the original... movie in the franchise featured Rose McGowan, who has been one of the leading figures in the Me Too movement and in speaking out against Harvey Weinstein.
Mm-hmm.
It Yeah, the ick level just goes through the roof. They reference the fact that Angelina has slept with Roman to get the part in the movie. The fact that, you know, that Roman was conceived to Maureen through this whole casting couch situation.
Yeah. And Evan Parker Posey says to Roman, "I'm the best you ever had."
Yeah, like, yeah. So there's a comment about her having slept with him as well. And it's just, it's ick. And then you go, oh, and this is a Harvey Weinstein movie. And it's just so ick.
But it just shows you how powerful and indestructible they thought they were.
He must have thought he was because so untouchable to make this movie.
100%. Like, he, before this script went to Wes Craven, it must have gone through the Weinstein first as well. And for him to sit there and go, oh, yeah, this is fine. Yeah. Fine,
well, maybe he thought that if he tried to block it, it would raise more questions. Who knows?
Well, maybe he doesn't. Yeah, but he could be like, this is insensitive. But for him to actually go, like, he must have sat there when the writer and director were going, penciling it out, and they're going, maybe we should have gone down this road. But they thought they were so indestructible with it.
Nasty. Makes my skin crawl. Ick.
It is ick. Really icky.
So I was going to do a list of alternative castings for this movie for you, because I do quite like that section. And the list was so bloody long that I was just like, we haven't got time. We haven't got time for this. It's basically a who's who of 90s. Name a 90s actor they were probably considered for a part in this movie. I will mention Jamie Lee Curtis was offered the role of Bianca Burnett, which was the Carrie Fisher role, but she turned it down. That would have been a lovely cameo, although I do love Carrie Fisher in this movie.
Yes, I do as well.
Yeah, basically every female actor of that generation was considered for one of the female parts. Tia Leone, Selma Blair, Kate Winslet, Shannon Doherty, Charisma Carpenter, Liv Tyler, Jennifer Connelly, Alicia Silverstone. It's just this crazy list.
One girl that you didn't just mention who actually was cast in this movie but then couldn't do the filming, so they recast her, was Kate Hudson was supposed to be Jenny McCarthy's character.
Was she?
She was with audition, she had the script, it was going ahead, and then she dropped out. And I think it's because she got really famous from Almost Famous, that kind of like really... Like, because I think that was a Miramax film as well, actually. And I think it got her to a different level. And I think she might have felt Scream was going to take her down a bit.
Maybe.
So she had the part, she had contracts, she had the script, and she just at the last minute pulled out. And that's why we have Jenny McCarthy.
Well, do you know what? I like Jenny McCarthy in this movie. So I like Kate Hudson, but I'm glad we have Jenny McCarthy, because I think actually for a small part, she does a good job on it, which kind of leads us into... What do you like in the movie?
We're going likes. Okay, so this is.
Oh, you want to go? Yeah. Let's go likes first. Let's go likes.
Okay. Let's go likes. So, I've had to sit and narrow it down. Now, I love the fact that they've gone into the Stab universe and letting us through the Iron Curtain of making horror movies. And I love the fact they're showing us the sets. So I like one of my favorite films of all time is Wes Craven's New Nightmare, what is another Wes Craven movie looking at the meta universe of horror within Hollywood and making horror movies. And it's one of my favorite horror films. One of my favorite novels is actually the original novel for Psycho 2, what came out just as the original Psycho did before the Psycho 2 movie did, but Universal Studios absolutely hated the novel and didn't want the author to release it because Psycho was originally a book. But the original Psycho 2 novel is played on the fact of Hollywood is making a movie of the first Psycho, and the people start dying on the film set of the movie of Psycho. This film really lends a lot from that book, and I kind of like love that book. And there's so many other movies that go across. I do enjoy the whole voice box and the whole voice translator stuff. I think it's fun. I really enjoy it.
Okay.
I do enjoy that. But I think that I would have liked it if they showed us how that voice box got invented.
Yeah.
Like a prop guy or something was doing it. And he was like going, oh, I can record a voice. And then you just need to get a sample of the actual person's voice and then you can record it. So like a phone call or something.
Yeah.
I think the fact that it exists without the technology is a little bit weird in this universe.
Yes.
I love the cast in this movie. I think everybody does a really great job.
Mm-hmm.
But no one, no one is in good in this film as Parker Posey is.
Parker Posey is the queen of this movie. This she was the point at which I realized that I had seen this movie before. So I put this movie on and I spent most of the movie going, have I seen this movie? I'm sure I've seen this movie. I don't remember any of this. And then Parker Posey appeared and I was like, oh, yes, I have absolutely seen this before because she absolutely is embedded in my memory. She's so good.
She's so good. I've liked Parker Posey for years. When she first started off in Tales of the City, the Amistad Maupin TV series, and she played Laura Linney's best friend from school in Living in San Francisco, the really slutty air hostess. Fantastic. If you haven't watched it, go and watch it. She's amazing in it. But Parker Posey rules the thing for me. I enjoy the whole film set stuff. A lot of people don't like it going from Woodboro to LA. It doesn't bother me that much. I think it makes a nice change.
Mm-hmm.
But they're the things I do like in the movie. All of them are like, I like this and I like that. But Parker Posey, I could just watch. I wish when this film got made, or even do it now, E! Network did like a mockumentary about her character as an actress, like post death, and did like really weird film scenes and stuff.
Well, she would be brilliant in that as well, because she's in, apart from Tales of the City, one of the first things that I saw her in was the, she's in Best in Show, she's in A Mighty Wind, all those sorts of movies. And she is so good in that style of thing as well.
She's fantastic. But she does play Parker Posey in everything. Even in, even in that Superman movie, what's the Superman movie when she comes back with Superman Returns, or where she plays Kevin Spacey is now Lex Luthor. She plays Lex Luthor's girlfriend in it. And she's just like Parker Posey.
But she's brilliant. I think Parker Posey should be in every movie. Maybe not every movie. Fantastic. She'd probably pull focus a bit too much. But most movies should have Parker Posey in. She's brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, she's fantastic. What did you like about it?
So I completely 100% agree on Parker Posey. She completely understood the assignment on this movie and completely owns it. But actually,
they blatantly brought her in. They blatantly brought her in when they were trying to pull it into more of a comedy than away from a horror aspect.
For sure.
They're like, let's get Parker Posey to play that.
Yeah.
And that's what they got.
But it works. And actually, I think all of the supporting cast are quite good in this. I think it's the issues in terms of the characterization are within the principal cast and particularly the returning characters, because you can see that that's where the writing just doesn't quite hold up. But for Parker Posey's character and for the other supporting characters, I think we get great performances. I love Jamie Kennedy's scene. I would have liked a bit more. I don't know how they would have done it logistically a bit more, because obviously he's dead. There was at one point talk of retconning that and having had him survive the movie, because there was a lot of backlash to him having been, they even reference it in this movie. There's a lot of backlash to having killed him off in the second movie.
Do you know who they were going to retcon in the original synopsis from Kevin Williams?
There was talk of bringing back Matthew Lillard. Is that who you were going to mention?
Stu
from the first movie.
He was supposed to be the main killer in this. It wasn't supposed to be Roman. Yeah. It was supposed to be him and the other girl.
But then again, because of the links to high school,
Matthew Lillard actually got paid for this film.
Oh, because he got that far with the deal and then just got cut.
Yeah, because the script was done and just got cut, but they reworked it.
Oh, good day in the office for him. I love that Jamie Kennedy's back. I really liked his scene, and I felt like you feel the dynamic of the movie change when you've got Parker Posey on screen, when you've got Jamie Kennedy on screen. It kind of, like you say, because they're bringing the humour, I suppose. Although Jamie Kennedy's scene isn't necessarily funny, it's not written to be funny, his characterization is so comforting, I suppose, to see him on screen, because he's such a loved character from the franchise.
Mm.
And those scenes really stood out for me, I think, because of their performances and because of the way that their characters were kind of portrayed. In terms of what you don't like, then, is this going to take a while? Do I need to get comfy?
No. I was very strict with myself. I was very strict.
Just 15 key points.
Now, I'm just going to road them off into bullet points and you can go, yes, yes, no, no. Okay, first thing of all, one of my main gripes about this movie, and I've mentioned this in the previous episode, is fucking Courtney Cox's fringe.
Oh my God, Courtney Cox's bangs. Oh, now we know where Sharon Stone got her inspiration for Basic Instinct 2.
Exactly.
Fucking hell.
And also the fact of that Roman gets killed with an ice pick. I'm like, has someone watched Basic Instinct 2? But it didn't come out to 2006.
This predates Basic Instinct 2, but yeah.
Probably that the fringe didn't. The fringe was like, let's get Courtney Cox's fringe and put it in Basic Instinct 2. So I was like, what the fuck?
David Arquette has claimed responsibility for those bangs. Apparently it was his idea. He suggested that she had, because obviously they were married at that point, she suggested that she had her fringe cut in like Betty Page, who was a 1950s pinup. If you Google image her, as you see, she had quite a short but quite a heavy fringe. It looks nothing like the fringe in this movie. She looks beautiful.
Oh my God, it's an awful
but,
fringe.
Courtney Cox's fringe. But then equally, although he claims responsibility for it, I don't think it was her actual hair. They used a hairpiece, but they'd positioned it in the wrong place. So when you have a fake fringe for movies, I'm gesticulating my hands like anyone other than Michael can see me. Obviously, this is an audio format.
I'm getting a whole hand but demonstration here, everyone.
The hairpiece gets clipped in quite near the crown towards the back of the head and then brought forward and cut into bangs. But they set it too far forward and then cut it into those shonky bangs. And it was the only hairpiece they had. Now, why they couldn't go down the shop and get another hairpiece?
I don't believe that.
That's what Courtney Cox said. That's what Courtney, but maybe she's just covering up the fact that her husband made her get shitty bangs.
Oh my God. I think it's like shit because it's a film set. It's a fucking film set.
I would shave my head rather than be seen with those bangs.
Yeah. Oh my God. No, that bangs. Yeah. And I was like, oh. Yeah. Hate the nightmare scene with the mum. I don't think that was, it's just that whole leaning into the supernatural element of horror. And I don't think Scream sits in that.
No.
And they're in, I am going to mention this, but I won't tell you what, but in Scream 5 and 6, they also lean into supernatural stuff as well a little bit. About some what people are imagining, and that really pisses me off about their movies as well, because I'm just like, supernatural stuff doesn't need to happen in this movie.
No, well, I guess they brought it in so that then when Randy mentions it later in his video clip, you go, oh yeah, we've seen that, and you it kind of gives credence to what he's saying. But I do agree with you that it doesn't fit in this movie.
No, I don't like it being a single killer. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. You know, I'd rather they've gone for three or four killers. It was more people in the film set would have made more.
Yeah, yeah. Could have been all of them
to me than have. Yeah. You know, and then they start picking them off with each other like some kind of battle royale towards the end of the film. Who's going to be a surviving killer? It feels very, very disjointed. Like it just jumps around too much. And it does that one thing that I fucking hate. And sequels do it all the time. And TV shows do it. We often talk about it in the last season of Murders in the Building. When you've got a popular cast and they're then wanted by other people, like for this movie, Neve Campbell wanted to go off and make Drowning Mona for Danny DeVito. And then you've got like Cox and Arquette that's available to do it. They start doing these separate scenes together and not for like small chunks, but for massive chunks of the film because they're not all available for filming at the same time. And it's cheaper for them to do that because it means less filming locations, less filming times, and, you know, it saves studios money to separate the main characters. But I hate it because it takes you out of the element because you're always like, well, why isn't Courtney Cox's character around? Why is they not, you know, why aren't they in the same scenes together? It makes no sense. Now, Angelina's accent in this movie.
Yes.
Now, she's British.
She's British. This is her first major role as well. So she, this is her first crack at an American accent.
Yeah, it drops in and out a hell of a lot. Like, especially when she gets scared, she jumps into an English accent.
Yeah.
Like the tail end of both of her accent drops down. I didn't understand what her accent, because they weren't going down the high school route of knowing Neve Campbell. Why out of character when she wasn't filming stab scenes? Why couldn't she be English?
I don't know. Well, other than that, there was a throwaway line quite early on from the guy playing Dewey's character in Stab 3.
Yeah.
Where he says something about, oh, you won a competition to take over the role from, because it was Tori Spelling played her, didn't she, in the previous installments of Stab.
Stab movies.
And she didn't return. There's the whole thing about, I can't believe Tori Spelling and David Schwimmer aren't back, which is good because otherwise Tori Spelling and David Schwimmer would be dead. Because those characters get killed off. But there, so he has a line about how she won a competition, which we know isn't true. She got the job by sleeping with the director. But obviously the line that was put out to the world was that this random girl had got the job by winning a competition. So I suppose that might be less believable if she was British. But I do agree with you. She could have just been British and doing shonky American accents when she's playing Sydney, which I'm not sure we actually see her do in the movie anyway.
No, we don't. But you could have easily just filmed the scene, go, you need to work on your accent. Doing some really southern, you know, they could have had just done a 2-minute scene and you wouldn't have to deal with the shoddy American accent the rest of the time in the movie.
Yeah.
But obviously the crew and Wes Craven weren't that noticeable to us.
Well, I feel like they didn't quite do enough research when they gave her the job anyway, because she also didn't have a work permit to work in the States. So she had to do a stop off in Canada on the way to shoot to get a permit.
Oh, for fuck's sake. This whole filming is a hot mess.
I suspect this might have been one of those situations where, like, you put horse riding on your resume and then someone goes, and this is the horse you're going to ride. She's like, yeah, I can work in the States. I can do an American accent. Oh, shit, now? Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, no. No. But it does open up quite well with that later on in the series, they could bring her back into it. Because no one believes that she's dead. No one believes she's dead or Stu's dead. You know, there are two characters that people still think are alive and living and in the Scream universe. Another thing I hated about this movie was too many fucking writers. If Kevin Williams is not available, put a fucking pin in it. They were worried about filmmaking this movie with Columbine. Just put a pin in it until Williamson was available.
Yeah.
You know? Don't be so money hungry. Just put a pin in it. Williams will be available a year later. You could get your contracts joined up with Campbell, probably sign her on for 2 more films at the same time. You know, at the time they didn't want they just wanted the third one to get it. They're just looking for money, and that's the thing that pisses me off. And finally, disappointing kills. Because everybody in this movie is just happily stabbed because they didn't show any blood because they didn't want too much violence on the screen. So they were going, okay, let's go for the soft approach of these gentle kills.
Yes.
And then, you know.
Yeah, there's no one getting stuck in a cat flap or, you know, any. The kills in the first two movies were much more creative.
Yeah. They were. It's just like stab, stab, stab. Well, it was called stab. So, you know, as a whole, these are issues that, like, don't get me wrong, I still fucking love this movie. But these are gripes with this movie that I've had for many, many years.
Yes.
And I turn a blind eye because I like seeing Gail, Sydney and Dewey on screen together. I like their chemistry and I feel like this film lacks that
absolutely
chemistry.
No, I completely agree. That's my first note that I've put of what I don't like, is that there's not enough Neve Campbell in this movie. It was in her contract that she was only going to be available for 20 days. So that's why she's in so little of the movie. But again, it's like, if Wes Craven is going to put his foot down about the gore and the violence and seeing the kills on screen, why is no one putting their foot back down about Neve Campbell needing to be in the movie? Like, if it's a Scream movie, you need Neve Campbell. If she's not available, and as you say, if she's not available, Williamson's not available, everyone's a bit about Columbine, give it another year. I know, you know, they will have been wanting to rush out another installment because it was a tight turnaround from 1 to 2. They'd already left it 2 years to 3. If you leave it too long, I suppose it goes off the boil and the world moves on and new franchises come in. Yeah. But I think the movie suffered from not having Kevin Williamson. Yeah. It suffered from not having enough Neve Campbell, not having Neve Campbell on screen with David Arquette and Courtney Cox as much.
Yeah.
That dynamic is missing.
Even in Scream 6, Neve Campbell's not in it because she refused to come back because of pay disputes, because they weren't offering her a good enough deal, and she's held the franchise together for a long time. You know, and I think it just shows they need to pay these actresses what they're worth. You don't get these, you don't get male actors. You never hear male actors distributing who are part of a franchise arguing about pay.
No, because they get what they want.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, like, and as much as I enjoyed, also enjoyed Scream 6, I did miss her. I missed her character being on set. I did miss her being in the movie. It just didn't feel like a Scream movie. It's not like a Scream TV series, like a step, sidestep away from it.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else you disliked about it?
I think most of what you've covered, I think that, to me, the biggest issue is the script, to be honest. It's the writing of the principal characters is too thin. You can see that Kruger didn't understand the returning characters well enough when he was writing them. Even Kincaid is a bit of a, like, what, Patrick Dempsey's character, like, what's the point of him?
The thing I don't like about this is the first two Scream movies, you have your suspicions who it could be and it couldn't be. But they never let you think it could be them. That was your own opinion.
Yeah.
But in this movie, they're like, I'm going to give you a dirty
too
look.
Many red herrings.
Weird to make you...
There's too many red herrings in this movie. They set it up for you to think movies, so many people could be it.
And the first two movies, they don't do that. They let you look at the characters.
Yeah.
And you look at their actions or look at the scene and see who's missing. Like, where's Wardo or where's Willie? You know, Willie?
Wally.
Or Wardo. What
where's Willie is a completely different thing.
Available in your local Soho shops. For me, you know, there's too many kind of like, look, we're dangling in front of your face. Could it be this person? And it's like, you know, it just doesn't work for me. It doesn't work for me. It doesn't make me go, oh. And I'm not a massive fan of the fact that it's her brother and it goes back and like retcons the first movie as well. I just think that's a bit of a cop out. I'm a bit
I think
the whole time.
I don't like to say it about the Scream, because the Scream series, one of the things that's great about it is that it's meta, but I think this movie just takes the meta a step too far.
Too far.
You know, it's all 100%. There's all those things about, you know, it's the third in a trilogy. That means we're going to go back and undo something that's been established from the beginning. And then you get the whole, the Princess Leia references, and you get all these little, there's just too much. Mm. There's too much going on. Too many nods to how it's going to turn out.
When they were making this movie, I think that was a problem. The studio were like, oh, we've made one and two. They've been huge successes. It is, there's too much hype.
Yeah. It feels...
And that really pisses me off.
It kind of feels like they've had a checklist as they're writing.
Yes.
Of like...
100%.
Because there are all those little moments. There's the like, oh, we'll be right back. And everyone who was in the previous movies looks at each other because we all know what that means. It's like a fanboy checklist. The whole thing of when Patrick Dempsey's character says to his partner, oh, this is all a bit like Seven. And what was the other movie that he said it was like? I can't remember. And then his partner goes, yeah, but in that movie, one of the cops died. And you're like, check, they're planting that. That's either foreshadowing or is it a red herring? Everything is, nothing's just there.
Yeah.
Everything is doing something. And because everything is doing something, there's too much going on. And so you can't.
Yeah, no, I agree.
You can't see the wood for the trees. It's confusing, and it doesn't feel like. And then you've got all these little plot holes around, particularly around the killers. Like the first two movies were watertight, and this one, there's just too much you can pick at and pull threads, and it just starts to unravel. And I think you're right. We it sounds like we're being very critical of this movie. You clearly still enjoy watching the movie. I enjoyed watching the movie. It's not a bad movie.
Yeah.
But.
No, it's just disappointment.
Yeah. It just doesn't hold up to the other two.
Yeah. And for me, who have seen all six, it doesn't hold up to the other six.
Yeah.
You know. So, Claire.
Yes.
How many stabs would you give Scream 3?
Well, here's the thing. So I've looked back at some of my previous ratings because I struggled with this one. I was like, how am I going to score this? And to keep it consistent with other scorings that I've given, because like I just said, I enjoyed the film. I quite happily watch it over and over for the sake of completion. I could quite happily do a trilogy weekend with you or with whoever at any point and go, right, we're going to watch the first three, or we're going to just work our way through the six. Yeah. And I would never say, let's skip three. Never.
No, never.
I will happily watch it, but it just doesn't hold up to the other two. So I feel like I want to give it a three, but if I'm going to give it a three, that means I need to downgrade Exorcist 2, which I scored a three in our last episode, because it's not...
You're backtracking.
Yeah, I'm backtracking because this is better than Exorcist 2, I would say.
Oh, far better. And certainly, so much better.
In terms of just a simple level of, would I watch it again? Like Exorcist 2, I'd watch it again if I needed to. This movie, I would watch it again next Halloween, quite happily. So I need to score it higher than that. But then I thought, well, I can't score it much higher than three, because I gave Flintstones and Viva Rock Vegas a three. I gave Maleficent 3.5. I can't score it higher than them, I think. So I'm going to downgrade.
Why not?
Because...
So now put it this way. How many stabs would you give Scream and Scream 2?
Oh, four or more. Yeah. I think as examples of the very specific subgenre of horror that it represents, I think I would probably give Scream 5.
And Scream 2?
4.5? I think they're both really good films. And this is a good film. So I would score it lower than them. I don't think I can... I wouldn't put it at a 4. Maybe a 3.5, I don't know. But it's all those plot holes bug me. So I'm going to settle at 3, but that does mean that I need to backtrack to our previous episode and downgrade Exorcist 2.
I'm not going back and editing the other episodes.
No. Well, this will be a nice surprise. For our listeners who listen to every episode, this will be a nice little plot twist for you, following on from the previous. Yes. How about you?
So it's messy. It leaves a bad taste in my mouth, but I would give it 3.5 stabs out of 5. And then the sequels, actually, Scream for me is a 4.5. Scream 2 is a 5 for me.
Oh.
Scream 2 is my favorite, one of my favorite sequels of all time. Scream 2, for me, is a better movie than Scream. And the fans are going to come for me. And so many people, so many people actually hate Scream 2 more than Scream 3. It's a massive thing out there. I don't know if you get it.
Don't get that.
People have their, but some people really like Scream 3 more than some of the others.
Look,
we did.
People like different things. And I do absolutely do not hate this movie. I do like it. I just don't think, for me, it holds up.
Yeah.
I think it needs Neve Campbell and it needs Kevin Williamson.
Yes.
Is the thing.
I agree.
For my money.
I agree.
Because they are what made the first two movies work for me, I guess.
Yeah, I would like to hear what you have to say about Scream 4. That, maybe we'll do a social media thing of you just
if we ever get to a point where I can watch it, if I can find a copy somewhere, I could just buy it. I know. Actually, buying a movie rather than finding it on a service I subscribe to.
But you do own the other three.
I've got the original trilogy box set on DVD, yes, or Blu-ray. Yeah. I can't remember. I watched them on streaming for the sake of ease. But yes, I have the original trilogy box set. But I don't think... Do you know what? Now I'm saying this, I'm going to go and have a look downstairs. Maybe I have 4 as a standalone.
I don't think you do.
You don't think I do?
Discussed it.
I'll have a look. No. I'll have a look. If I've got it, I'm going to watch it.
Because you bought me years ago for my birthdays.
Yeah.
The box set of trilogy on Blu-ray, didn't you?
I did.
I remember.
I did. Back in the day when we were young. Back in the day. So that's Scream 3 for you. Listeners, please take a moment to rate us and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any new episodes. And tell us what you thought of the movie. You can leave us a comment. You can email us on unlovedsequels@gmail.com. And you can find us on all the socials at unlovedsequels.
So it's goodbye from me, Michael.
And from me, Claire.
Take care, guys. Bye.
You're obsessed with her, and you're obsessed with her daughter.
All right, easy, Geraldo.